Hello, and welcome to Stepping Into Truth, the podcast where we take on the issues of race, gender, and social justice. I'm your host, Omkari Williams, and I'm very glad you're here with me today. I love doing this podcast. I'm privileged to speak with people who are out in the world making a difference with their day jobs, their programs, their art, their activism. If you would like to support me in doing this work, you can do so for as little as $3 a month by becoming a member of my Patreon community. You can go to patreon.com/Omkari Williams and sign up. There's also a link on my website. One of the things that I'm most passionate about is people finding their way to an activism that works for them, an activism that they can sustain, an activism that feels like part of their life. My guest today is someone who has done exactly that. Ari Hanavar is the founder of Rumi with a View, dedicated to building music and poetry bridges across war-torn borders. Her work has been featured on NPR and in the New York Times, and she is the author of the Oracle card set and book, Rumi's Gift. Her upcoming novel, A Girl Called Rumi, is forthcoming in 2021. I am so pleased to welcome Ari to the podcast. Hi, Ari. How are you?
Hi, Omkari. Thanks for having me. I'm good.
Yay. This is going to be such an interesting conversation for me because you intertwine things that I really love. And I'm going to let you tell people about that. But let me start by having you tell our listeners a little bit about your background, because I really feel that there's a direct line from your personal story to the activist work that you're doing in the world.
Of course, yeah. So I'm originally from Iran. And when I was six, women of Iran lost their right to ride a bicycle, jog, or be judges. The women, their rights were cut in half. And we actually had to sit on the back of the bus, literally. And this happened in a matter of months when the Islamic Revolution happened. It was a revolution, but there was a power grab by the Islamists. And this just kind of shook our world and changed our lives dramatically. And so, and our freedom of expression was really restricted. Of course, we didn't have the right to complain or criticize the government, but we also lost our right to sing in public, or most of music was banned. So just dealing with a lot of limitations kind of helped us be creative in ways that was not so obvious. So we had to use a lot of creativity when our creativity was being limited and hampered.
Huh. I mean, as a six-year-old, that must have felt so weird because, you know, you're six and you're used to being able to go out and just skip down the street and sing with your friends and dance around. And it sounds like all of that was gone essentially overnight.
Overnight. And then a year later, Saddam Hussein took advantage of this turmoil and attacked Iran and started a war that lasted 8 years and took a million lives. So we also had to deal with the terror of bombs and missiles on top of that.
I just can't even imagine what that would be like to wake up every day and know that potentially someone could drop a bomb on your house and you and or your family could be killed. I just can't even imagine what that would have been like. But what did that lead to in terms of how the society kept functioning? You said you got creative. What did creativity look like in self-expression in Iran in those days?
Well, we Persians have a long history of poetry, poetry has saved us in many ways. It has helped us survive despotic regimes and invasions and personal horrors that happen in everyone's lives. So we have had this thread of poetry has survived through the ages in Iran. So many people took to poetry because poems were still, you know, allowed. Women could recite poems, nothing political, but they were able to sometimes use these really beautiful, intricate metaphors to show what oppression was. And we use storytelling as a means to just be able to survive and keep our spirits alive. And we danced in secret, and we made each other laugh in secret. So that was how we learned to deal with years and years of oppression.
Wow. I you know, having grown up in the United States, it's just hard for me to imagine what that would have been like, but humans are adaptable, and we figure out how to get through hard times, and we figure out how to save things that we love. So I think that that must have fostered great creativity in the people, specifically the women of Iran at that time. So that is something I have a lot of respect for. So, okay, so now we have a little understanding of your personal story. And I know that some of the work you do is very much connected to that. And one of the organizations that you're involved with is Musical Ambassadors of Peace. And I would love to hear more about what they do and how it is that music can be used to facilitate peace.
Sure. The organization was started by Cameron Powers and Christina Sophia out of Boulder, Colorado. And right after the Iraq invasion, they were two very astute musicians, talented musicians. They went to Iraq to sing Iraqi love songs on the streets of Baghdad. And people were very surprised, Iraqi people. They're like, wow, you guys are not military, you're not contractors, you're not trying to profit from us in any way, and you just kind of are singing our love songs. And they said, yes, we're somewhat of reverse missionaries. We're not here to preach, we're here to learn. We want to hear your stories. We want to learn more songs. We want to take all of your beautiful culture back to the people of America. So that's how it started. And I was very inspired by this way of using music to build bridges between countries where their diplomatic relations have collapsed. And that's something I've been doing with poetry. So when this opportunity presented itself, I became one of their musical ambassadors and started holding drum and dance sessions for the Middle Eastern refugees who were in, you know, just newcomers in California. And then when the whole asylum seeking debacle happened in 2018 and the mistreatment of migrants from Central America, from Nicaragua, parts of Mexico and Honduras and El Salvador, you know, by the CBP, by the Custom Border Patrol started happening. They would not let the asylum seekers in, and the detention centers were horrific places and still are horrific places. They're still not letting asylum seekers in. So I decided to take this and adapt it and bring it to people who were stuck in Mexico, people, refugees, very much like me, who just had to leave everything behind and are stuck in Mexico in shelters trying to find their way to the U.S. And part of the beauty of this is that this is something that was denied to me as a child. Music and dancing was denied to me as a child. So I was able to bring that and also combine it with the sense of community, which I really lacked when I moved to the US as a 14-year-old without my parents. I longed to have a community. And so this is a way to create that sense of community and ease anxiety, tension, depression through dancing and music for refugees.
I find that just thinking about people who come and have left everything and everyone they know behind, and just how painful that must be, because we are communal animals, and not having community is incredibly challenging for human beings. And so as you're working with these refugee women who are dealing with the trauma related to leaving their home countries and the trauma of coming to the border, thinking that they would be welcomed and finding that they are not, what kind of work are you doing with them? And is your experience that this is actually bringing some sort of emotional support and relief to them and their children?
Yes. What we do is, again, create a sense of belonging as we go. I go with, when I did go before the pandemic, now we do those sessions through Zoom, but I would bring musicians and helpers who are just there to serve the needs of the shelter. So we would bring donations and food and, you know, just hygiene products and monetary donation, just to make sure that the basic necessities are taken care of. And that, you know, it's because if you're stressed about your next meal, it's not, you know, you don't necessarily want to just leave your worries behind and dance, you know. So just creating a space of where you feel cared for somewhat, for at least for the time being. And then, you know, we would just be in this kind of a spirit of how this dancing is kind of a ritual. It's sacred. We bring essential oils and everyone smells the peppermint oil. Even the old ladies in the back come in and they just breathe deeply too. And it's kind of like a sacrament that we do. And then we say that what we do while we're here is like, we're just not dancing and singing to have fun, which we will have fun, but also to boost our immune system, to give our stress and our anxiety and depression to the ground, just shake it all off. We're here so our children can collectively feel safe. And we do this, and then we create this kind of a safe space where we can dance and we can celebrate the moment. And then at the end, we will use all the senses, of course, to do this. And at the end, we have a little snack. And then if people are particularly traumatized, we stay back and offer them some resilience building exercises and just ways to deal with future challenges, how to just calm the nervous system and be more at ease with this given circumstances.
So that must be really challenging right now to try and do this work over Zoom. How is that working out?
It's definitely different, because the screen takes away so much of our cues, our macro expressions and ways. And of course, you know, one of the hardest things is that when we would go there, we would hold the babies so their parents could dance unfettered, you know, just go ahead and have fun for a few minutes, you know, and leave your worries behind. So we can't hug the people we're dancing with, and that's the probably the hardest thing. So we just send a lot of kisses to each other through the screen, and we hug each other, hug ourselves as a way of hugging them, and so there's a lot of love, a lot of verbal love and pantomime and love that goes over. And so that's kind of how things have changed. And we can't wait till we go back. And if people have issues, they stay back and they send me a message through the chat, through the Zoom chat, and we address those.
I have to say the thing I miss most in this pandemic world is hugging people. And I did not realize how much a part of my being it is to just hug people. And I'm so looking forward to the day that I can just go out. I'll probably hug strangers on the street, but that's okay. Or not. So given that we are in the middle of this pandemic and that the United States is completely failing to get our particular outbreak under control, I mean, we have 4% of the world's population and nearly 20% of the world's deaths and 25% of the world's infections. So I think it's fair to say that we've done a terrible job of getting this under control. And, you know, even with this, we're still in this battle of whether we should wear face masks or not, whether it's an infringement on our personal freedom, even though scientists have told us that they're very effective in reducing the spread of this virus. So you were a child in Iran, and you understand what tyranny looks like. And I would love for you to talk about the argument that requiring wearing a face covering is a form of tyranny.
Right. So the right to infect others it's just baffling to me, because that's basically what you're doing when you're wearing a face mask, you know, whether it's a debate on how effective it is to protect yourself, but it is fairly shown that yes, the respiratory droplets coming out will infect others, and it has some protective aspects for the wearer of the mask too. So this just is really ridiculous that people equate the freedom to infect others with like their individual rights, and it's you know, we were forced to wear hijab in Iran. Some people were okay with wearing hijab. Many women were not. And that, you know, the government was like, well, this is going to protect the moral fiber of the society, women not showing their hair, which is such a ridiculous and abstract kind of a thing. And it just reeks of oppressing women and controlling women's bodies. Whereas during a pandemic, which is such, you know, the pandemic is not going to last forever, you know, it's going to run its course and then it's going to be done. And for this limited period of time, when you go to a grocery store, to a closed space where people are, you know, just exposed all the time, the workers are exposed all the time, it seems that it would just be the decent thing to do. Even if you don't believe at all in the science or the wearing of the mask, you know, just to put them at ease so they're they feel comfortable as they are essential workers.
I think that's a really good point that we don't necessarily often think about, is that, you know, yes, we understand that wearing this is to protect someone else, but I don't think that we often think about it as, even if we don't believe in it, we can do it, because basically, really, how is this any skin off of your nose? You know, it's like, okay, so you might think that this is all BS, but for the person who's working in the grocery store where you're buying your food, just for their peace of mind to have a mask on, even if you think it's ridiculous, is not harmful. And it's actually part of being a member of a well-functioning society. And that actually sort of brings me to my next question, because right now we are not, here in the United States, a well-functioning society. We are a deeply divided country. And I'm curious, again, with your perspective of having grown up in Iran, what you see as the dangers of a society that is as split as ours is right now.
Right. It seems like the foundation is, which it was already cracked. It seems like it's already, it's this huge chasm right now. And it can create a lot of issues. So I was talking to someone the other day, and I was like, yeah, you know, we were used to daily funerals and long ration lines and state-sponsored brutality in Iran. You know, that was our new normal. And I never imagined as a 14-year-old when I left Iran that I would migrate to a country that I would, you know, like be the normal again, you know. So the division is of course very damaging to our soul as a nation. In Iran, you know, spies were everywhere. Neighbors would spy on neighbors. Family members would turn each other into the government. And it was heartbreaking on so many levels. And we have that right now. It is difficult to watch that people aren't seeing each other's humanity. But at the same time, there is a lot of people have woken up in a way that they hadn't before to the plight of Black folks and asylum seekers. And just the way that the system is so rigged is becoming much more advertised than before. And there is a lot of people that are doing good things, and I would like to address that in a moment too.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up in a bit, but before we get there, I just want to sort of tie this up, because I think that part of the challenge right now is that we are not only isolated in our individual groups and our political stances, but I think that there's so many people feeling personally isolated. And I know that you've written about isolation, and I think that overcoming isolation is in itself an act of activism. And I would love for you to talk about that.
Yes. The whole idea of individualism was this bad experiment, the TV dinners of experiments, which has failed miserably. This idea that you can have your nuclear family and not have the village has caused us to be so unhealthy as a society. The loneliness is the other epidemic that has been going on for years in the US, and it's killing us. It's worse than smoking a pack of cigarettes a day, that sense of isolation. And to overcome it is you have to kind of overcome towering obstacles, because especially with, well, during the pandemic is a whole other issue, but with the age of social media and not really being in contact with others, it can really become its own prison. So yeah, to come out of it is really difficult, but it's absolutely necessary for us to start functioning again as a society.
Yeah, I have for quite a while felt that social media, for all of the opportunities it offers on the one hand, is actually making us more disconnected from each other rather than more connected. I mean, we're superficially connected, but the meaningful connections, there's so little of that. I mean, you'll go out to a restaurant in those days when one did that, and you'll see people sitting and everyone's on their phone. Rather than talking to one another, they're all engaged with their individual phones. And it just pains me, because I feel like we lose something when we stop being able to connect meaningfully with other people around us. And it's challenging to overcome that because phones are addictive. I mean, they've done an excellent job of getting our attention and keeping it. So I feel like this is a struggle that we need to engage in more directly because it does have an impact on how we see other people and how we have compassion or lack thereof for other people's plights in the world. So it feels to me like it's an important piece of being an activist is to actually engage with other human beings in a direct way, not just on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter sort of way.
Absolutely. And they've done studies where, you know, our implicit bias gets really checked as soon as we are in contact in person with people of an opposite group or a different group that we're not used to being around. And we have all these preconceived notions or set of ideas about them, shorthands that we stereotype people in. And then that just kind of gets dissolved as soon as you see people, as individuals, as living, breathing humans with ideas and ways of dealing with things.
Yes, as they say, it is hard to hate up close. And I think that we need to shrink the spaces between us so that we can actually have some more comprehensive understanding of other people's experiences and points of view and hear their stories and be able to connect to our stories, even if we don't necessarily agree on everything.
Absolutely.
One of the things I definitely wanted to talk about that you referenced a bit ago, you and I sit on the board of a nonprofit human rights organization, Gente Unida, and I'm a brand new board member, but you've been around for a bit, and I would love for you to talk about Gente Unida and some of the work that's happening on the southern border, but also for other causes around social justice.
Yes, of course. So Gente Unida is a human rights group, and the main objectives are to help migrant children get the Black and brown vote out, and also, you know, just the intersectionality of the fight of activism that when you start looking at one population, you start also seeing how others are oppressed or vulnerable or not cared for. So they have hands in many, many activist pots right now. And one of the pots is the Floyd Rights, which is floydrights.org is a grassroots movement that takes a human rights first approach to how law enforcement deal with individuals. And their efforts are meant to bolster the Fourth Amendment rights. So the Floyd rights are kind of like Miranda rights. When since 1966, we've had the right to remain silent upon arrest. But what Floyd rights bring into the table is having the right to be treated with dignity, respect, and without injury. And the goal is so the police will respect everyone's fundamental rights. And once those rights are fully articulated, understood, and defined, then this helps protect more, kind of like when Miranda rights, every police officer in the country had to find a way not to violate the Miranda rights. So the idea is to change legislation on state and federal levels to bring this. And they've had some great success. So that's one of the organizations that Gente Unida is collaborating with. The other ones are many other border rights organizations. We have programs in Tijuana, Mexico, and protests here, weekly protests to bring justice for Breonna Taylor. And yesterday, and Vika Morones and others went to the Petco Stadium, Petco Park, and asked the Padres, the baseball team, to walk off because no justice, no games. So definitely a lot of involvement with the intersectionality of the movement of social justice.
I think that's so important because, as you said, when you start looking at one cause, you can see the tentacles of other causes in there. It's nothing is really separate. Whether if you're talking about feeding people, you can't really talk about that independent of other rights that you give people, just treating people with decency and respect. I mean, everything just winds up coming back to that basic premise of treating people like people that you care about and want to treat with fairness. And then, you know, obviously there's a job for the police to do, but we need to really look at how we do policing. And that encompasses really looking at how we engage with civilians in general, how we engage with protest in general, how we engage with giving courtesy and compassion. I mean, the whole situation at the border is a prime example of that, because we would never want our own children in cages. Why would we put someone else's children in cages? So one of the things that I really appreciate about Ente Unida is that it does work with other groups, and it does reach out and say, the broader we can build this coalition, the more impact we're going to have in our efforts. So I think that's very, very important for people to realize just across the board. I mean, even in your own community, you will get more done if you reach out to people whose goals may not be exactly what yours are, but that have relevance to your goals.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah. So that just, I'm always trying to sort of beat the drum for collaboration, because it goes back to that whole idea of isolation. And it's very easy for us to get isolated and feel like, well, I'm just working for this cause and I'm going to put my focus here. But we are stronger when we look at how this cause does connect to another cause and we join forces with other people. And also it just makes us better people. We get different perspectives and we learn more and we get to challenge some of our own biases that we otherwise might not notice.
Absolutely.
So our time is coming to an end, and I would like you to give us three simple actions that the listeners can take if they want to just deepen their own practice of activism and make it more a part of their every single day life.
So I definitely want people to go to change.org/Floyd Rights and sign the petition. So we can get this on the attention of legislators. And then also go to Gente Unida and Musical Ambassadors of Peace websites and learn how you can get involved. But the third one, which is kind of a personal homework, is finding creative ways that work for you to infuse your activism with joy. Because what is easy and joyful is sustainable. And we really need to have a sustainable way that we move forward with our activism, because there's a lot to be done.
I love that. That is so important. And I think that often people think of activism as being hard work. And I'm not saying that it's not, but hard work doesn't have to be joyless work. So I think that's very important. And I will list all three of these things in the episode notes for this show. And I just want to mention to people, so Floyd Rights is actually named in honor of George Floyd. There will be a link to that as well. Well, this has been so interesting, and I'm so glad we got to talk, Ari. I really appreciate all the work you're doing and the ways in which in very challenging times, you do continually bring joy and laughter into the lives of people who so much need it right now. So thank you so much for that. And thank you so much for being a guest today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your beautiful podcast, Omkari.
Oh, thank you. And thank all of you for listening. There's so many things that need to be put right in our society at present, and that can feel truly overwhelming. And the antidote to overwhelm is to do one small thing, and then the next, and then the next. You'll build your activist muscle, and you'll make a difference for someone right now. This isn't about doing everything. It's about doing the thing that is yours to do. So please keep making your contribution and have faith that others like Ari are making theirs. I will be back with another episode of Stepping Into Truth very soon. Until then, remember that change starts with story, so keep sharing yours.